Okay, here we go with some more questions. Dear Ajahn Brahm, that's a nice start. Please advise instructions for meditating in the standing posture. Thank you. Now the Buddha said there are four postures: the lying down posture, the sitting posture, the walking posture, and the standing posture. I've given instructions on how to do the sitting and the walking meditation. Interesting, nobody's asked me about the laying down meditation because you're all experts at that. But the standing position, yeah, there was a few people who used to do that. One of the people who used to do that, if you know him, Christopher Titmus, he's a teacher over in England and sometimes goes to the United States. He would do that, but it's a very difficult and painful thing to do because he had to stand for a couple of hours, motionless. It can be done, and the experts in there, and you can actually see people do standing meditation. If you ever go to Buckingham Palace and you see those little guards doing standing meditation there, but you know, they don't seem to get enlightened. So really, standing meditation is not a pleasant meditation, simply because to stand still for long enough, it's not a very, very comfortable position. After a while, your legs start to ache and you start to worry about falling over, you lose your balance. But all it really means is that, sometimes you are standing around waiting for things. You may be standing around waiting for the monks and nuns to come for the food to be served, waiting for them to finish and give the blessing so that you can meditate, so you can eat. So those times, especially at the breakfast, at the lunch time, there you're doing standing. Just like, be peaceful. Main thing, be here. Be in the present moment. And don't go thinking, when are those monks going to be finished? When are those monks going to be finished? Don't they know I'm hungry? Don't they know we're waiting for this? So no, stay in the present moment and be silent. And just know the feelings in the body as you're standing. That's all you really can do for standing meditation. Next. Dear Ajahn, for a long time, my motivation to do what is unpleasant comes from, I feel I have no choice. B, I believe it has a purpose that agrees with my principle, or if I do that, I am closer to Nibbana. This is doing things which are unpleasant. I heard what you said about signing books the other night and reflected, if I were you, I wouldn't have the motivation, because it's something that, as if you do have a choice, and it's not something particularly dharma or wholesome to me. Signing books. It's not against the five precepts. Anyway, but for myself, it's making people happy when you sign the books. And even taking your photograph. They take that photograph back, and sometimes you have a picture of a monk, or sort of a Buddha statue or a nun, and sometimes it can inspire you and make you happy and make you peaceful. I know that I've done that before. There's one of my favourite monks, Ajahn Gunha. If ever you've got a photograph of him, he's just got this wonderful smile which just makes me laugh. It's a little bit like Benny Hill, if those of you know Benny Hill. It just reminds me of him every time. So every time I see that, I think, wow, this is really a funny monk. And he's such a lovely monk. So when I see his photograph, it always makes me feel happy. So that's a wonderful thing. If you have a photograph and it makes you feel happy, and it gives you inspiration, that's a great thing to have. So that, I think, is a noble thing. So having your photograph taken and signing books, these aren't sort of just rubbish books. These are things like Opening the Door of Your Heart and The Art of Disappearing. All these books, which are very, very powerful and very deep dharma, some of these. So it's great that I can sign these and encourage people to read them. So I think that's actually wholesome, but sometimes I have to do things which are unpleasant because it does actually hurt sometimes my arm. Well, two or three years ago, I've got this weird characteristic. It's if it's something unusual I've never done before, I really like to actually give it a try, see what happens. So two or three years ago, when I was in Medan in North Sumatra, there was over 1,000 books I had to sign. That's before the talk, and many about the same afterwards. And signing that many books, 1,000 is a lot of books to sign. And afterwards, I could not raise my arm. Literally, my muscles had all jammed up, and it was really sore. And that evening, I really thought, is that sore? You're not going to be able to sleep that night because it was really throbbing. But, you know, it's always great, good karma there. You know, I did that as an act of just selflessness, just because other people, it made them happy, and they wanted to have a book signed by me. But then there was this Thai monk there who gave me a Thai massage afterwards, 15 minutes. And it was amazing. After 15 minutes, all the aches and pains had gone. I had a really nice sleep. It really worked. So there are some times when this massage business, it's incredible. You know, just, I was really in pain, and I couldn't lift my arm. And afterwards, I could lift my arm and sign another 1,000 books the next night. Brilliant. And I think a lot of times that was because my whole attitude was, you're doing this just to let go and to make people happy. So I had wholesome intentions. So if you have wholesome intentions and you injure something, there's always some good karma comes up and you heal yourself pretty quickly. Can you please somehow convince me that maybe I don't have a choice in life and somehow everything is dharma-related, so I can motivate myself to willingly embrace irritation that comes to me that I don't particularly agree with? More grace and equanimity in life. There are many unpleasant and unwanted things that come our way. If we have a choice, why is it wiser to embrace them rather than simply refuse what is disagreeable? Thank you so much. Usually, if it's something disagreeable, you know, especially as a monk, I take it as a bit of a challenge to try and make it agreeable. So what's wrong with signing books? It's just your attitude you have towards it. Oh, I don't want to sign these books. Why do I have to sign these books? Couldn't they actually print the signature in the books when they print them? And actually they did in this last book, but they still made me sign the other page. But it's that attitude which I realized was the problem. Signing the books was not the problem, the attitude was. And the old story, this is for the person who's written this question. Where I learned this attitude problem was the story of building Ajahn Chah's main meditation hall and ceremony hall in his monastery in Wat Ba Phong. He built that hall, and because it was a very flat area of Thailand, he made a hill to put it on, to raise it up a couple of meters. And I wasn't there when they actually built the hill, and it's all monks' work, it's not sort of machines. But there was a lot of earth left over, and Ajahn Chah wanted it moved. So he got the monks from the other monasteries. Wat Nanachat was just, you know, was about an hour's walk away, or 5 minutes in a car. So he asked us to come over for a few days so we could help with doing this hall. It was like merit-making. It's good karma. I understood, even as a Westerner, that if there's something to do, karma is really important. So if you're building something in a monastery or if the monks need some help, yeah, you help out. Maybe I was an Asian in my past life, but certainly, you know, I really feel the need for good karma. So if they need some help and it's a good cause, I'm there to help out. So yeah, I was very happy to go out there and help my teacher because he needed some workers, some laborers, and I was young and fit. And so that we had to move the earth. He told us, there's a big pile of earth over here, we want to move it over there, he told us. And I knew it was really hard work. Now this was in like the jungles in Thailand. I was born in London. I was not used to the heat. So you're always sweating a lot. And when you sweat a lot, you know, and you get very hot, there's more mosquitoes come, so heaps of mosquitoes were biting you. And we only had this one meal a day. And I've told you many times the sorts of food we ate. If it slithered on the ground, that's what went into the curry. So some disgusting things I ate. And it wasn't just they were and I really mean disgusting. This is no exaggeration. If I told you all of the things which I ate, okay, here it goes. Like cow's afterbirth. The placenta of the bull, you know, the cow's afterbirth. That was one of the things we ate. Ants' eggs, and the red ants as well. And snails in northeast Thailand, they were like chewing erasers. They were just that rubbery. Now the worst part of that, some disgusting things which you ate, the worst part of it was that, you know, it didn't taste good either. It tasted disgusting. It's probably about tasted worse than it actually looked. So it's very, very bad food. And it also didn't have much nourishment to you. So everybody was always very thin, always having diarrhea and those sorts of problems. So that was the food you ate. So you were very thin and very malnourished in the heat, being bitten by mosquitoes. And our morning meal was finished by about 9 o'clock. So about from 9:30 to maybe about 8 or 9 o'clock in the evening, we were pushing wheelbarrows of dirt. When it got dark, we had oil lamps so we could see the way. And it's very hard work, you know, when you worked about 12 hours just on such a small food. Just stop for water or Coca-Cola, you know, or Pepsi-Cola, whichever they had. That was what kept you going. So, after 3 days, it finally finished. And I was really tired. And of course, once you get close to finishing, you start thinking, tomorrow I can have a nice shower tonight and rest, you know, wash my robes, which were filthy, and catch up with some meditation. And I deserved it. 3 days of hard work. But I felt really good about that. I'd helped my teacher. And that night, Ajahn Chah went off to visit another monastery. And the following morning, the deputy abbot, Ajahn Liam, he's now the head monk of Wat Bapong, he called all the monks together after the morning meal. He said that, you know, he looked at where we put that earth, and it was the wrong place. He said it didn't look good there. And he had a point. You could see his argument. And so he asked us to move that earth. So it was another 3 days of hard work. But, you know, he had a point, and I was fit, and it was good karma. So, you know, I decided, okay, no trouble. So you worked really hard. And after 6 days, you felt really exhausted, and you really were filthy, and you did really need to wash those robes and wash yourself and just have a good rest. And that night, Ajahn Chah came back. And the following morning, he said, "Why have you put that pile of earth there? I told you to put it at the other place, didn't I? Move it." And at that point, I lost my faith. Because these senior monks, they didn't shovel the earth and push the wheelbarrows. They sat under their hut talking to people all day. And I had to push this earth. You know, and just, you know, 6 days I was filthy, I was tired, exhausted, hadn't done any meditation for days. I didn't become a monk to do this. And I got very upset and angry. And as usual, you started swearing, because that's what Westerners do. Australians, English, Americans, when you, Belgians, whatever happens. Whatever happens, once you get upset, you swear. And even though the monks could understand, you know, the swear words in English, they could see that you were upset. And one of the monks came up to me, and that's when they told me, and I don't know who this monk, I can never remember him, but I certainly remember the instructions. And this, one of those moments has changed your life. He said, "Pushing the wheelbarrow is easy. Thinking about it is the hard part." And I was open to understand exactly what he meant, and it hit me like a sledgehammer. How stupid could you be? And I stopped thinking and stopped complaining. I stopped being irritated, even though you had good cause to be irritated. I stopped and just pushed the wheelbarrows. They were much lighter. We had a lot of fun just working with the monks, cracking jokes and messing around, racing each other with the wheelbarrows just to make it fun. And those 3 days went past in a flash. And it was finished, 9 days. Of course, I was very relieved that they'd finally decided that's where they wanted it. So the 10th day I could wash and have a good rest, which you deserved. But that particular episode where I was getting so irritated, and it was just because I was thinking too much. When they said, "Pushing the wheelbarrow is the easy part, thinking about it is the hard part." Wow, that's so true. And that's what I've taught many people. You may be having an operation, say a mastectomy or a prostate operation or whatever else it is. Thinking about it is the hard part, doing it is so easy. Or you may have an interview for a job. Or you may have some other irritating thing which you have to do. So thinking about it, that's what causes the irritation and the pain. Doing it is just so easy. So I say, whatever irritates you in life, it's because you think too much negativity. Just do it. It's finished very quickly. And it's so easy. Even for those of you getting on a bit, even dying. Dying is an easy thing to do. Just do it. Stop thinking about it. So that's how we dealt with those irritations in life. And look, spending 9 years in the forests, in the jungles of northeast Thailand with disgusting food, really, really bad climate, and lots of mosquitoes and diarrhea, there's plenty of stuff to irritate you. But you refuse to be irritated. You learn so much from the shit of life. You dug it in, and it became fertilizer, and grew these wonderful flowers of wisdom and fruits of compassion. The irritations of life are the shit, which is begging to be dug in somewhere to create a beautiful garden. So that's what you do with irritations. Ajahn, did you say that controlling and concentrating can actually get you a nimitta, but not jhana? How can controlling get you one so far? I thought if you control, you fail sooner than that. Thank you. Now, it's a lot of time people have incredible willpower. You know, because look at some of these athletes, you know, which you see, you know, training for the Olympic Games. And they just push themselves so much, going through enormous pain. You know, because they got this goal, they want to go to London, they want to get the silver medal. A lot of them just, they come back totally frustrated and disappointed because only a few people can get the medal. Most people have to fail. But they've got incredible willpower. And you've seen people with willpower. Sometimes you have got great willpower too. And if you really will it, yeah, you can will yourself to stay with the breath. If you trained yourself, nothing else. I'm not going to allow one thought. I'm going to stay with my breath, and that is it. And sometimes you can build up that power. And I've seen people get as far as the nimittas with willpower, but again, they can't get to jhanas. They just cannot let go of control. And as soon as they do let go, it all sort of falls apart. But again, I agree with you, most people don't get that far. They can get onto the breath, and after a while they get so tense, they get headaches, and sometimes they get sick as well. Just holding their mind so tight for such a long time. And they do that because they think that's what they're supposed to do. They think this meditation, to succeed, you have to have strong determination. And it's not. This is one thing which I've been teaching a long time. How I practice, how I've got my meditation together, how I've seen so many others, how I understand the teachings of the Buddha. The Buddha's a compassionate one. He's not like some sergeant in the Marine Corps, with this being boot camp. That's not what this meditation is all about. You try that and you get very tight, very tense, you just never can get very deep. One of the fundamental reasons is the more effort you put in, the stronger your ego, the stronger the sense of self. If you do get a nimitta, I got that nimitta, I tried, I forced it, I worked hard, it's mine. Because that's what happens when people do a lot of controlling. Whatever they do get, they think they have earned it. That it's part of their sense of self. Another thing which they add to their medals on their chest. It makes them who they are. People who are very successful in life have huge egos. That's why when you fail, when things go wrong and you don't make the grade, isn't that wonderful? It's humiliating. It diminishes your ego and sense of self and makes you a much more compassionate person so that you can understand other people who fail. You can be kind. So I found not many people who are always successful have very, very big egos. And a bit of failure is very good for you. It really brings you back to earth. So that's what happens if you try hard. All you end up doing is feeding the sense of self and make it bigger and bigger and bigger. But letting go, just being kind, being gentle, making peace, because you're not doing anything, your sense of self starts to diminish. Your big ego vanishes because you're not getting nimittas, you're not getting jhanas. It just happens when you disappear. And then you understand some of these wonderful teachings in these ancient books. One of those great teachings, which I think one range retreat at Bodhinyana, this was the key teaching for the whole range retreat, which I gave to the monks. So the path is, but no traveller on it is seen. That's from the Visuddhimagga. It's beautiful. The path of meditation, the path to enlightenment, is there, but you can't see any traveller on it. Nobody walking that path. No doer. No meditator. If you disappear, you the traveller, then the path manifests. The more you're meditating and doing this, the narrower the path is. The more you disappear, the wider the path is, so you just cannot miss it. You have to follow it. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. So don't be a traveller. Don't do the meditation. Don't force it, because if you do use that willpower, you are the traveller and you get lost. I agree. This is just some experience. I have seen people with strong egos. They do get to nimitta stage, but they can't get any further. Nimitta doesn't last. It's unstable. And they can't get into these beautiful jhanas. They just can't let go. They can't let themselves go. This controller. I was saying to someone earlier in one of the interviews, because we were talking about, you know, some of the other traditions, you know, that the old medieval monastic traditions, people like St. John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila, who they seem to have got into these jhanas. And one of the reasons they could do that is because they surrendered to God. That was what they said. Now, surrender to some higher power means their will could totally vanish. They didn't have to do anything. For the rest of us who don't believe in a non-existent God, if you don't believe in these things, it means that when you let go, you've got nothing to sort of rely upon. That's why it's much scarier for Buddhists. If you're a Christian, when you just, oh, God will look after me, no worries. You've got nothing to be afraid of. But it's much scarier for Buddhists, because when you let go, there's nothing left. So you think, ah! So that's one of the reasons why that a few of those people managed to get into these jhanas, because they could let go of their willpower. They could let go of the control, because they believed in some higher being who would take over for them. And that's one of the reasons they got into those states. It makes a lot of sense to me. But it is the willpower which is one of the big problems. And later on, if you get some deep insight, you will find this thing we call your choice, your willpower, is literally enemy number one. You really think that that's your friend. That if you train your willpower to be a bit wiser, you'll have a very happy, successful life. But in deep meditation, you feel that, no, it's not training the willpower as a way to happiness. You find that willpower does not belong to you. It doesn't come from you. It's not under your control. And it's a thing which really messes you up and causes you a lot of suffering. It is the torturer. Craving, otherwise known as will. But you can't see that yet. Because what I'm saying challenges you totally. My will is my friend, it's me, it's my essence. And many of you have lived your life getting a strong will, determined will, planning, having goals, that's all part of developing the will, and trying to make it smarter so that your will can actually achieve what it wants. But you'll always get frustrated. It never works. In fact, the will won't let you rest, won't let you have any peace. No matter how much you have, your will keep you moving. That's why the will, Chaitanya, part of Sankara, is dukkha, is suffering. And when it stops, when there's no will at all, when you're totally peaceful, and nothing inside of you is telling you to do something next, or get something more, or get rid of anything. When the world has totally stopped for a while, oh gee, what peace, what bliss, not to have this boss, your will, telling you what to do all the time. That's what it feels like. Freedom at last. Anyway, you'll find that out later on down the track. Dear Ajahn Brahm, just to say, thank you very much for a greatest piece of wisdom this morning. I wonder which one that was. With the lowest three bows. Very good. I like fan mail. Much more fun than criticism. But I told you at the very beginning of this retreat, any praise or any sort of thanks that comes to me, you can put it to me, any criticism goes to the manager, Bianca. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. Is it possible to attain a jhana without a nimitta appearing? Or perhaps its appearance is not recognized as such. Exactly. Yes, you can attain a jhana without a nimitta appearing. It's there somewhere, but you just don't see it. You just go straight through. I was also telling someone earlier today that these jhanas and these nimittas are just what happens when you let go. They're natural states. If you let go, they just happen. Even if you're not, if you don't know anything about them. There's a couple of cases, you know, in my life as a teacher, people have come up to me, you know, and these are people who aren't even Buddhist. I remember this one young lady, I think she was from Rockingham, just, you know, to the east of here, west of here, sorry. And she sort of had this amazing experience when she was young. And so I listened to her, and she, I don't think she'd ever been to the monastery before, hadn't even sort of read any books, so she didn't really know what she was talking about. She described it, I thought, my goodness, that's a dinky die, straightforward, right down the line, typical jhana. You've just had a jhana. You know, so a couple of years ago. And she got really interested. Oh, that's what it was. Now, what usually happens, like this other lady, and she was another classical case, I was in Penang teaching a meditation retreat, and the organizer said, look, there's this Buddhist lady here, and she's had some sort of psychological problem. Now, the counselors can't help her. Can you give her an interview? You know, just to see if maybe you can figure out what's going on with her. She's gone a bit crazy. And so I'm always sort of very kind. I say, okay, wheel her in. So she came in and she told me she had this experience. And again, I said, oh, that was a jhana you had. Don't know how you did that, but you pressed the letting go button and you had a jhana. And I told her the other thing she experienced. She said, yeah, that was it. How did you know that? I said, that's just typical. That's what happens when you get into these jhana states. And because of what I said, she knew that I knew what she was up to. And she left totally happy. She hadn't gone crazy. She'd had an experience which no one had understood. And that made her so worried and confused. She thought she'd had some sort of psychological breakdown. And all it was a deep jhana experience. So well done. And I've had a couple of people like that. It's just happened spontaneously. Simply because they've totally let go. For one reason or another. They haven't done anything. They've subdued or let go of this control and they've sat there, closed their eyes or whatever, and all these things have just happened to them by nature. So that's why these things are natural. So it's not, do I have to get jhanas? What do you mean do you have to get jhanas? It's not I have to. It's just what happens. When you let go, this is what occurs. So it's par for the course. So it's not have to or you don't have to. You avoid it, can't avoid it. It just happens when you let go. If you really let go, this is what happens. If you don't let go, they don't happen. You have mentioned that you have sat on the rock upon which the Buddha meditated at Vulture's Peak. Oh, yeah. Look, you say that and it starts to make me tingle again. That's really powerful. I have not been there, but cannot imagine they just let people sit there. Was this a special privilege for monks? No. Monks, men, lay women, anybody can sit there. That was one of the beauty of it. Because no organization, no church has built a great cathedral over it and charging people to come and see it. Nobody has built a wall which separates ordinary people from going to sit up there. You just go up there, there's no one up there, there's no entry fees. I think there's a gate at the bottom these days. You just go and sit there. Don't have to charge anything. Maybe somebody else says, oh, my turn now, that's about all, because there's a lot of people. But it's totally free and open. And that's what I loved about those holy places. Because you know some other places, holy places. I mean, I remember seeing that, talking about one of those Christians, St. Francis of Assisi, a really, really poor guy. One of the things he did was build a small little chapel, just a tiny chapel, maybe the size of, I was just thinking, I don't think there's anything this small in this, maybe about the size of the place where you put the rubbish bins. You know, about that size. He built a little church, built it himself. And because he became famous, they built this big cathedral over it. And you can see the photos, this little church, and this huge monument, about five times higher to the ceiling. And I think, my goodness, they've missed the point here. This guy was simple. And now you've tried to capture this simplicity in this really over-the-top cathedral. You know, just flaunting your wealth and power. Well, this was a simple guy who just built such a simple church. And sometimes we miss that simplicity when we take, say, the rock in which Buddha sat on, and we can only see it from a distance, guarded by the most senior monks, and all you can do is bow or throw flowers or give donations for its upkeep. Now here, actually, you just go and sit on it. Isn't that beautiful? Okay, I'm going to cause a lot of problems now. I don't mind sort of challenging people. Every now and again, we have these relic exhibitions. I remember going to Singapore to see the relic exhibition and having to see this incredibly long queue, and people having to pay money to get in. And when you went inside, there's only a few relics there. And there are more relics over the road in Bodhinyana Monastery, where any time you'd like, you can just go up into that dining area and just see them. And they're right in front of you. You know, you don't have to go way over there before you can see it. But I remember many times going to Sri Lanka to the tooth relic there. And you can't even see it. Even as a monk, and I was very privileged because I'm well known in Sri Lanka. I'm a famous monk in Sri Lanka. So I remember they came and said, oh, you can come right inside. All you can see is a box. They don't open the box. But you guys, you can't even see the box. You can't even get close to the room in which the box is in. It's such a long way away from you. And I thought, this is not right. Separating people from these things. And that's why it's brilliant when you can go to sort of these places and you sat in a rock and you know the Buddha sat on it. Or you can go into the other cave, the Bores cave, just below where Sariputta became enlightened. You can read it in the suttas. You can sit in that cave where the sort of the second most famous monk was listening to a teaching and just cracked it and became an arahat. All those places are just there. And you just go there and just hang out as long as you want. Don't have to pay any money. No monks at the entrance charging things for you. Monks sometimes are very mischievous. I must admit, I'm one of them. So I don't mind criticizing my kind by trying to make money out of these things. No, this is for free. And that's why it's incredibly inspiring. It's simple. This is how the Buddha lived. Just in a small cave on a rock. And it reminds you of that. It reminds you of what a monk is. So yeah, I try and emulate that. But just imagine, you sit down and on this rock, and you know the Buddha sat down there. Whoa! That really gets you going. Inspiration. You don't have any sloth and torpor. Maybe a bit of restlessness because you get excited, but you certainly get lots of energy and happiness up. That's brilliant. So you can do that. Go and do that one day. It's there. They haven't moved that rock. It's still there. There's actually plenty of rocks around that area. And you know, it's just very clear from all the descriptions. You don't have to have any doubt whatsoever. It was actually, it's called the Vulture's Peak. I know when I was up, there's been a lot of people up there since, but there was, you can see why it was called the Vulture's Peak. There was a rock up there. It's just a rock formation. If you look at it from one angle, it looks like a bird. It looks like a rock. And no one's put it up there. It's just a natural feature. And it's obvious when you say that's why it's called a Vulture's Peak, because it was a rock formation that looked like a vulture. And being a rock, it's been there for centuries. And maybe now that sort of because people, you know, are just messing around up there, they may destroy it after many centuries. But when I saw it, it was obvious that that was the Vulture's Peak. So you can see why it was called the Vulture's Peak. The description, fat, the Vinaya, that was the place. You can go there and get inspired. Sorry for saying that, but I really get off on those things. In daily life, how to avoid job stress, study tension, criticism, discrimination, stress, etc. Very easy. Leave daily life, become a monk or a nun. Why do you want to keep going with the daily stress, study tension, criticism, discrimination, etc.? Because look, you can lessen it. by your wise attitudes. But you can't get rid of it, because that's what it's like in work. If it wasn't stress and tension, they wouldn't need to pay you. That's why I don't get paid, because I've got not enough stress. So the Buddha side doesn't need to bribe me to do this job. I enjoy it. If you really enjoy your job and get lots of satisfaction, tell your boss. And the boss will say, well, I don't need to pay you then, do I? You're happy coming to work. Your salary is a bribe to make you do something you'd rather not do. So work will always be some suffering for you. Will be tension, stress. So that's why you can lessen it. And you learn how to lessen the stress of daily life here. And I'll give some more talks about that the last day. But in the meantime, you're not at work. You may never get to work. You may die before you get home. There's many days left. People do die, you know. Just like you. And it can be any day. So this question, you think, just, you know, once you're a ghost, you think, why did I ask that question? I never got back to work. I died beforehand. So shut up. Ajahn Brahm, when we go back to our normal life, another one. No, it's not the last day of the retreat yet. You're too far ahead of yourself. How many of you already started packing your bags? Crikey. When we go back to our normal life, this is more normal, it's abnormal where you're going. It is more difficult to maintain mindfulness in speaking situations where someone or where some miss there are negative feelings, or where we meet negative feelings to deal with, such as anger, jealousy, greed. Which is the best mindfulness technique to use? If you're meeting negative emotions of other people, remember they belong to other people. They don't belong to you. So don't get infected. You know, when there's diseases around, you wear these masks so that none of that bacteria can actually get into your breath and infect you. When other ones have negative emotions, now put these little things in your ears so they don't infect your mind. And that is like wisdom and compassion. There they got negativity, but that's their negativity. Why do you get infected by someone else's bad karma and make it your own? So you refuse. If someone else is negative, that's your problem. You can be negative as you want, but your problem is not my problem. In other words, don't carry other people's suffering in your heart. You've got enough of your own. So, if they say bad words, if they criticize you, if they scold you, what do you do? Why have you got two ears? One to go in, one to go out. Yes, boss, yes, boss, yes, boss. And then you just walk away, totally happy. Because you haven't kept anything in your brain. But if anyone in the office, or especially your boss, gives you praise, don't forget to put one finger in the ear. So it goes in and doesn't come out. And you can keep that. So that's why, just don't let anybody control your happiness. They can do stupid things, get angry at you. They're getting angry at you because they want to make you upset too. They want to infect you with their unhappiness. But you don't need to be infected. Regarding the sutra on the removal of thoughts, do the five methods only work on the level of thought, or are they work on view and perception as well? Also, do they only work with a lot of mindfulness? Okay, that's methods for overcoming all these stray thoughts. And I've already given one of them is substitution. In other words, instead of thinking, you just use one simple thought. You know, like Om Mani Padme Hum, or Namo Buddhaya, or breathing in shut, breathing out up. So that's a substitution, which eventually that thought you substitute can very easily be let go of, because it's a more simple thought. One of the other ways is seeing the danger of those thoughts. What am I thinking for? They're just spoiling my beautiful mind, peaceful meditation. That's where you see them as like carcasses of dead dogs. There's another way, you just see where they come from. You know, they're just thoughts, that's all. And actually, that where they come from, because often many of you have the impression that sometimes you're meditating and these thoughts come from nowhere and they just come into your mind. And you didn't want them to come in, you didn't go seeking for them, they just come in. If you look at with a bit more mindfulness and you have more insight, you'll find these thoughts never come in uninvited. You went looking for them and dragged one into your mind. That's what happens. Because that's what happened to me. I thought, I was sitting, I'm peaceful. Where did this thought come from? And first of all, I thought it came in by itself. But when I became more mindful, more alert, I saw, no, I was getting a bit bored. So I went out there looking for a thought to bring into my mind. In the same way that sometimes you're bored at home. So you turn on the TV. What's going on? Just go through all the channels. Nothing on the TV, even though there's 60 channels. You go into the refrigerator, which is packed with stuff. There's nothing to eat. That's usually what happens. And so this is the mind. You're just looking for something to distract itself. So a thought comes in. So the cause of those thoughts is another way. It's examining the cause of those thoughts. That is usually discontent. You're not happy. So you look for a thought to distract yourself. Which is one of the reasons, if you can learn how to be content with anything, this is good enough, I'm just going to be here, you find the thoughts don't come. You don't need to be in jhanas to be content. You can just have sloth and torpor. I'm just content with the sloth and torpor. This is good enough. It's just part of nature. I'm not going to fight it. And then thoughts don't come in. So those are some of the ways which you can get rid of. What's the, I know that one of the last one is just using willpower. I was trying to sort of avoid saying that one because that really is a last resort. You only use that one. You use willpower to stop your thoughts. If you've got thoughts like, I'm going to kill that Ajahn Brahm tonight. I'm going to go into his hut with one of the knives from the kitchen. I've had enough of his bad jokes. If you have a thought like that, please use willpower to suppress it. For that, you are allowed to use willpower. What's the fifth one? I forget what the fifth one is. No, that's substitution. I already used that one.
Two
substitutions.
The second one is the dog.
Yeah.
The third one,
yeah.
Tracing the thoughts.
That's where it came from, yeah. I invited it. So, yeah, they work on the level of thought. Do they work on the level of view and perception? Thought, view and perception are inextricably linked. So if you weaken the thought, yes, you do weaken the views and perceptions as well. So you may have this thought, I hate that girl. She just makes all this noise in this room all the time. So if you weaken that thought, then you can also weaken the perception as well. You start to see her in a different way. Oh, she's not that bad. You know, she's maybe makes a bit of noise, but most of the time she's quiet. And that changes your view. It's just one example out of many. It's amazing how we get angry at somebody. And if we can just calm down that thought, other perceptions will come in. Hey, they're not that bad.
Is that the one where the Buddha talks about walking, running, walking, standing and sitting to slowly transform a perception? Is that?
That's actually for fear. I think you're talking about the Bhayabhava Sutta. So if you get some fear coming up when you're sitting down, don't move until the fear goes. And if you're standing,
walking, running, and then why should I run? I'll stay still. Why should I stay still? I get tired of standing still.
Okay, that's the plug, yeah. That's the plug, one thing after another. So you've got a very strong thought, then make a not-so-strong thought, then a medium thought, then a light thought, then no thought. Very good, but it does work on perception and view as well. Next question. Ajahn, thank you very much for the teachings. I found more peace and quietness. It's a super retreat. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Written, is that my writing? No, it's not. Dear Ajahn, I experienced something that could probably be described as happiness, which was different qualitatively from the delight I've experienced previously. This happiness felt less energetic, calm. It was only after I emerged from this that I realized that my headache is still here. Could you please explain this particular phenomenon of feeling happiness in the midst of a headache? Because a headache is just one feeling, and it's a feeling in the body, and this is probably sort of a mental sensation of happiness. And sometimes you have the headache, you know, which is a pain, but then you go inside the body and you can't feel the headache, you feel the happiness instead. Right. Mentioned that sometimes that people say, well, can you meditate when you're sick? And I've obviously had many personal experiences of being very sick, and the first one, which was really powerful for me, when I had scrub typhus, it's like typhoid, in the hospital, feeling terrible, no energy. And I tell many stories about third world countries in the remote part of Thailand, which was in Ubon, in the monks' ward, which was very, very tough. You know, it was really third world. Well, actually not third world, more like fourth or fifth world. But it was tough there, and I remember just feeling really sorry for myself, aching all over, in the middle of a fever, no energy. And then just deciding, come on, you know, do some meditation, you're a monk. And so just laying down there in bed in a fever, started watching my breath, letting go, and getting into a really nice deep meditation where you couldn't feel your body and you couldn't feel the fever. And no aches anymore, it's brilliant. And just went into this lovely meditation. I was having the time of my life, obviously, because you really appreciated it when, you know, it was a fever and your body was really hurting beforehand. And it came out afterwards, oh, that was so nice. And the body was really relaxed, but, you know, you could still feel the aches afterwards. But one of the things I noticed there, I noticed just my posture. And I just got into a very deep meditation. I'd never seen that posture in any meditation book, ever. You know, a leg this way, a leg that way, the arms all over the place, because you're in the fever. And, you know, I saw that you can get into a meditation, any posture, it's not important. And it's also, you can get into a meditation even in the middle of a fever, if you know how to let go. So that's what you do. Maybe not a fever, a headache, but you went inside, the headache went off the radar, just like when you're watching the TV. What's on top of the TV, underneath the TV screen, disappears as you go into the center of the screen. That's all that happened there. But usually if you do that, that headache would be much, much less. I'm surprised it actually was there when you came out. Because usually what happens, if you have some ailment, a headache or a tummy ache or even a fever, you go into that meditation and when you come out, it's not there anymore. You know, the deep meditations especially have a huge curative effect on the body. The body balances itself and afterwards you're fine. Can we practice all that we have learnt to the same depth once we return home? You haven't returned home. You may never return home. I may extend this retreat for another 9 years. There may be a coup, there may be a nuclear war, there may be a tsunami. We're high up here, so we won't be worried about the tsunami, but it means you won't be able to go back home. You'll be stuck here forevermore. So don't worry about returning home. That's a way off into the future. Could you please explain what number rupa means? Is it the same as the breath meditation we're doing here? Thank you so much for your wonderful, gentle, caring guidance. Now, nama rupa was very clearly and easily explained in the Samaditti Sutta by Sariputta. Very simple. Nama rupa goes with consciousness, the six types of consciousness. Nama rupa is basically what the consciousness is aware of. That's all. Just like the TV is like consciousness, and nama rupa is what appears on the screen, the programs. That's all it is. Which is why the Buddha kept on saying, these two depend upon each other. If you've got nothing on the screen, there's no consciousness. In other words, no objects, means the consciousness turns off. No consciousness is obviously no objects to be seen. That's all it meant. And then sometime later on, up came the Abhidhamma. And it was later on. It was not the teaching of the Buddha. Again, people get really upset at me for saying this, but one of the nice things about being a Buddhist, you can say whatever you want. There is no such thing as heresy because, you know, there is no hierarchy or big boss. As I said yesterday, the Buddha said, when I die, let the Dhamma and the Vinaya be your teacher. And you can just go to the Dhamma and the Vinaya and see very clearly. In all the accounts of the first council, 3 months or 6 months after the Buddha passed away, every type of Buddhism which records that first council described what happened. 500 arahats came together to collect all the teachings of the Buddha. And first of all, they've got Upali. He was the Vinaya master. And he recited all the rules of Vinaya. And that was followed by Ananda, who recited all the teachings of the Buddha, the five Nikayas, the Pancha Nikaya. And everybody knows what those five Nikayas are. Digha Nikaya, number one. That's the long discourses. Majjhima Nikaya is number two, the middle-length sayings. Sanyutta Nikaya, the connected discourses, and Guttara Nikaya, which is the numerical discourses, and lastly the Kudaka Nikaya, which is just the miscellaneous. And that was it. There is not even any mention or even any sort of mention or even any sort of indication of any Abhidhamma. It simply wasn't there. That upsets many people, but the evidence is very, very compelling. And later on, we get these Western scholars who have not got any axe to grind, they don't support any tradition, and they go and look at the language which is used in these suttas or in the Abhidhamma or in the commentary. Because if I started reading out, say, a passage from Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, and then read out some Shakespeare, and then read out some Charles Dickens, and followed it up with some Harry Potter, each one of you will be able to know which was written earlier and which was written later. How do you know there's a difference between Shakespeare and Harry Potter? Because the language changes, the grammar changes, the words change in time, as they do in all cultures. So that's how you can find out roughly when something was written. And the scholars have been to work on the suttas and the Vinaya and the Abhidhamma, and it's very clear, you ask all the scholars, the Abhidhamma was about 200-300 years after the time of the Buddha. That's the evidence. But that's Nama Rupa. The Abhidhamma really confused it on that one. And they just have a totally different meaning. So I wouldn't follow the Abhidhamma. I'd follow the suttas. Very, very clear. Nama Rupa, it goes with vijnana consciousness. It is basically the object of consciousness. And the body and mind objects. It's very simple, but when you get an Abhidhamma, it just gets so complex. Thanks, Ajahn. Now I can finally enjoy my wife's cooking and be honest about it. Do you want to find out who wrote this? Or your wives? Very good. Well, must be because you're very mindful, but if you lose your mindfulness, you'll start complaining about her cooking again. Memory of my past childhood. Oh, this is nice. Memory of my past childhood keep coming up during meditation. Why is this happening? So how can I stop this? Okay, if it's past childhood, and sometimes that when people ask those questions, it's unpleasant memories of your childhood. That's why they keep coming up. If there was pleasant memories of your childhood, you wouldn't be asking me this question, you'd be enjoying it. So So it's usually unpleasant memories of the childhood, and one of the reasons is because you think that you can't let it go. Somehow or other, there's attachment to the past. That's why you can't just let it go. One of the things is that that's not you, that's a totally different person. Many of you have seen my 60th anniversary book, where you've seen many photographs of me. Are you really sure those photos of that cheeky boy and that baby, are you really sure that's me? This may be one of those jokes which me and my brother have played on you, just to show the person many years earlier is not the same as the person today. You can see a connection there, but I am not the same as I was when I was, say, 6 or 7 years of age. So why do you carry the pain of another person into this present moment? There's a connection there, but you're not the same person. You know that. If you understand anatta, non-self, you understand that stuff done by that boy many, many years ago is done by a different person. I don't need to carry that karma. No more than I need to carry the karma of Venerable Gotami. It's your karma you've done. I'm not going to carry it for you. I can't. And I won't carry the karma of when I was a kid, let alone the karma from a past life. If you understand that, you don't identify with that past person, then the karmic connection is cut. No longer do you have to suffer the guilt, the anger of something you didn't do it, but a person connected to you did. A person connected to you by this chain of cause and effects which has now evolved into this person right now. It's a beautiful way of letting go. And that way you don't have to worry about all this stuff which happened in the past. Even what happened 1 or 2 years ago, that was a different person, if you understand anatta. So you don't need to feel responsible and guilty for it. Move on. Learn the lessons. Like I learned the lessons from other people, you can learn the lessons from your early life. But don't feel guilty about it. Let the karma go. You know, sometimes when I say this, especially to schools and universities, no, you can't let the karma. If everybody let the karma go, they'd just do whatever they like, they'd have no responsibility. They'll have no remorse when they do things wrong. So we need punishment, we need remorse to stop people doing the same bad thing again. And what happens when we have remorse and guilt and punishment, otherwise known as prisons? Does that stop people reoffending? And everybody knows, as soon as you get out of prison, you do the same thing again. There's always just going in and out of the prisons. That's why punishment, remorse, guilt, people think, oh, that stops the problem. It doesn't. It perpetuates the problem. If you punish someone, all they learn is not to get caught next time. They don't learn not to do the thing. If you feel remorse about something you've done, that just makes you lose your sense of self-worth, so you don't want to try doing good things anymore. This is one of the reasons why when you blame yourself, when you feel guilty, it is bad karma, and that bad karma which you take on board, you don't have to, punishes you, which means you can't soar to the heights of goodness. So it's absolutely, once you see it, the most crazy thing to do is to feel guilty and to punish yourself. It's absolutely ridiculous to anyone who's got any insight. If you've done something wrong, you acknowledge it, forgive it, which means no punishment, and learn from it. What we say here in Australia, and only Australians understand this, AFL code. Acknowledge, forgive, learn. Because that's one of the Australian football codes. The AFL, acknowledge, forgive, learn. No punishment, no remorse. If you understand that, if most people understood that, there'll be hardly any sort of, there'll be much less crimes and bad stuff happening in the world. Is it correct to assume that one cannot gain real insight without attaining jhanas? Yes. Very easy. Nati janang apanyasa panya natiya jayato yamhi janang chapanya cha sawe nibbana santike. Verse 372 of the Dhammapada. There is no jhana without wisdom. You need a bit of wisdom. You need some insight to get jhanas. And there is no insight without jhanas. In the one who has jhana and wisdom, they are in the presence of nibbana. Verse 372 of the Dhammapada. Brilliant. They all go together. You need the jhana to get insight, and the insight to get jhana. The front and the back of the hand. Dear Ajahn, is it okay to find out the reason why we can't go deeper in our meditation during the time we are meditating, especially by the time we are stuck there? Thank you. Yes, you can. What you do is you just pause for a moment and you stand back. What's going on? And sometimes it's like you come across a brick wall in your meditation and you just can't go through. A lot of people try banging their head against a brick wall. What happens? You get headache. There's an old joke about that. I haven't told a joke this evening yet. You know, in the Jewish tradition, they've got the Wailing Wall in sort of Jerusalem. You've seen the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem? And that all these Orthodox Jews, you know, in the big black heads, black hats and the dreadlocks, you see them. They literally do knock their head against the wall. And one journalist was seeing this rabbi knocking his head against the wall. What are you doing that for? Said, I'm trying to ask God to get some peace in the world. He said, are you getting anywhere? No, it's like knocking my head against the brick wall. But they do that. You can see the photos of them there. So no, instead of knocking your head against the brick wall, you stand back. And when I do that, I stand back. I see there is a doorway just over there, which is open, you can go through. On the other side is a ladder, you can go over. A lot of times those brick walls are only because you can't see widely and you just keep going bang, bang, bang. Just go to a little bit to the left, a little bit to the right, there's a way through, a way past. And that's usually what happens. In particular, you know what, there's a couple of tricks, you know, which work for me, and I'm just sharing this with you. If I get into my meditation and I get stuck, it's not making progress. Number one, what do I want? And sometimes I stop that meditation, what do I want? And sometimes I don't even need to answer that. I know I want something, and that's the problem. I want nimittas, I want jhanas, I want this, I want that. Even good things. And that I know from bitter experience is the problem. So I just say, what do I want? Okay, that's what I want. No, I don't want anything. This is good enough for me. I'm staying here. And as soon as I give up wanting, you just go straight through and go much deeper. So stop yourself and ask, what do I want? You'll find out there's an answer there. You want peace, you want stillness, you want something. That's why you make no progress. So ask yourself, what do I want? The other thing, which sometimes works, again, I mentioned it earlier, that I'm not focused in the moment. It's blurred, smudged. So I just focus, present moment awareness, come on Ajahn Brahm, right this moment, that's all there is. And as soon as I really focus in this moment, again, there's no past, no future at all, and then you just go very deep. And it's amazing, just once you see it, straight away, just you see the problem, and you get swoosh, you just get sucked deeper in. Just, you know, you can't stop yourself. What's the other one I do? Oh, the other one is just kindness, a little bit of metta. Because sometimes the meditation is a bit dry. So I stop myself and I just give a bit of a smile. A nice smile. There you go. Bit of metta. And straight away, just that change of attitude of mind, straight away you just go very deep. Those are the three things which I do. Just make sure that I'm not wanting anything. Just really in this moment, really focus in the moment. And lastly, just kindness. And that just whoosh, straight through. So those are some of the blockages. I'll mention that more tomorrow. I said that the teddy bear, because someone's got a nice picture of the teddy bear on there. It's actually a pretty accurate drawing on the piece of paper. Be kind, be gentle, be peace. Hee hee hee. Dear Ajahn, every evening there is a bright star in the western sky. What is it? That is, Jesus is about to be reborn in Janaka. I think it's western sky. Is that Venus? Well, that Venus, yeah, it's Venus. Yeah, okay, yeah, Venus, okay. It could be Singapore Airlines coming to land. It could also be the meteor which is coming to destroy Earth. So forget about going home and all these questions about what to do. Is delusion a sankhara, part of which khandhas? What is delusion? Is it a thing? Okay. Delusion is something which infects other sankharas. It is created. It is a sankhara itself because it's created. You create that delusion, you sustain it, and it bends reality. So you see what you want to see, not what's there. And what you don't like seeing, you just cannot see because it troubles you too much. That's what delusion is. So in other words, it's like the mirage. What the Buddha said, this is okay for the five khandhas. He said this body and the floor on which you sit, the brick walls and even planet Earth, it's just like a lump of foam which is just going on the Ganges River. It's just foam, that's all. You look deeply into it, there's nothing there. As a theoretical physicist, I know, wow, that's incredibly profound. The Buddha saw the foamy nature of matter. Because that's what it is. You know, you take your body and split it up, it's just made of cells. You take the cells, and they're just made of molecules. Take the molecules, they're just made of atoms. You get the atoms, they're made of electrons, protons, and neutrons. You take any one of those. They're just made of quarks. And there's nothing there. Just total emptiness. And if you go deeper to the Planck level, that's what they say, it's just froth. That's the word the quantum physicists use. Because you can't really tell what's in there, it's just froth. And it's amazing, exactly the same word the Buddha used for the quantum level. And that's as far as you can go, you can't go deeper than that. Heisenberg's uncertainty, you just can't say anything deeper than that. Even time becomes frothy at such small, it's just empty, you can't make any sense of it anymore at such small moments of time. So there's nothing there, it's totally empty. Sometimes as in science class, you started to think about this and you just blew your mind. You're sitting on a chair. But you know that's 99.26 nines, nothing. There's a percent nothing. There's only a tiny bit of matter there which, you know, interacts with your bum to give you a force so you don't fall through. But there's other little matter like neutrinos, billions of them coming from the sun, going right through you in this very moment. But to those neutrinos, you're totally invisible. You just go straight through. They don't interact at all. And you don't know. They're showering through you right in this moment. Because to them, you're absolutely empty. There's nothing there. And this whole space, we're in a very weird part of space. There's, you know, a bit more concentration of matter than is usual. In fact, very, very weird. But the whole of space is totally empty. There's nothing there. All this matter, stuff which we try and accumulate, is totally empty. That's brilliant. Even money. Remember Ajahn Chah gave this wonderful simile. He was telling the future. He said one day that people will run out of paper for banknotes and they'll run out of metal for coins. So they'll have to look for something else to use as currency. And he said what they'll use is chicken shit. These little black pellets, and that will be the currency of these countries. And people fight to the death over a bit of chicken shit. And they'll fill their pockets with the stuff. And they'll be so proud that they earn more chicken shit than their neighbours. And they'll store all the chicken shit in these big banks. And the IMF will become the International Manure Fund. Because what's the difference between chicken shit and pieces of paper? Absolutely nothing. It's just the value we add to these things, isn't it? So if you've got some chickens, save up the chicken shit. It may be worth a fortune later on. So that stuff and these sensations, happiness, pain, sadness, beauty, whatever, he said it's like a raindrop falling into a puddle. Plop! And then it's gone. Just how quickly the pleasures vanish. That's a simile he gave to the pleasures and pains of life. Now, I remember those of you who are cultured, who remember the great Scottish poet Robert Burns, otherwise known as Rabbi Burns. Pleasures are like poppies spread. You pluck the flower, the bloom is shed. Or like the snowfall in the river, white for a moment and then gone forever. But he said that in a Scottish accent, which I can't imitate, but being a Sassenach, I can't do that. But that's his great poem, one of the great poems. Pleasures are like poppies spread, you pluck the flower, the bloom is shed. Or like the snowfall in the river, white for a moment, gone forever. The Buddha said, a raindrop, plop, and it's gone. That's all this pleasure and pain which we keep seeking or trying to avoid. And perceptions. These perceptions. Oh, that is really one hot chick. That's Barbara over there, by the way. Oh, he is so ugly. That was such a wonderful lunch today. Oh, I hate that food. All of those perceptions, the Buddha said, are mirages. It's just like the water on the hot road. It's not water, it's just a reflection of light. We're adding to it something which is not really there. All these likes and dislikes and perceptions. We've been taught that. Like I usually mention the perception of the taste of beer. When I was 14, I had my first half pint of beer, sneaking into a pub in Richmond, totally underage, illegal, just because, you know, I wanted to taste this out. It was a rite of passage for a young man. And when I tasted that beer, the thing which people spent so much money on, and they'd go out Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday night, that's what they would drink. It must be something very special. And when I drank it, it was disgusting. It was like urine. And I thought, why? It wasn't sweet, it was bitter, it was frothy, and got up your nose. And why do people want to drink this stuff? But that was my first impression, but I knew I could not sustain that. Peer pressure, the very fact that everybody else said that was delicious, meant that I had to change my perceptions. And eventually I did that. Eventually I liked the stuff. Because I had to. And I remember that. If I'd have been honest, beer would have tasted awful. But I changed my perception to fit in with everybody else's. And just to be rebellious and to challenge you, very often I tell people, especially in Australia, you know, people think that sex is pleasurable. It's only because you've been conditioned to think like that. Just like I was conditioned to think that beer was delicious. Is sexual orgasm pleasant? Or is that just what you've been conditioned to perceive? Now that's challenging many people. One of the fundamental assumptions of life is that sex is a pleasurable experience. And I say that because the Buddha said that to Ananda. He said, the pleasure of sex is a perversion of perception. It's not pleasant after all. We've all been so brainwashed by our culture to think it is. And now you experience it as pleasant, as highly pleasurable. Not because it's inherently pleasurable, but because you've been totally brainwashed to believe it is. And you get a guy like me who said it's not, and think, you're weird. You really should go to a psychologist and get treated, Ajahn Prabhu. Simply because I go against the stream. That challenges you. So that's perception. That's what the Buddha said. The next one is sankharas. My goodness, we're going to be late tonight. Who cares? Especially will. That's the main part of the sankharas. Also includes the thinking. The Buddha said that's like the banana tree. It's got no pith to it, no heart to it, it's nothing, no essence to it. But the banana tree was very common to Asians, but not really to Westerners. So I put my hands up to Bhante-ji, Venerable Gunaratana, who used that simile but got a much better one. He said the sankharas are like the onion. Because an onion is the same, you peel it, there's nothing solid inside. You look at thinking, there's no solid truth inside thought. In will, there's no person doing that will. It's peel it and nothing happens. But when Bhante-ji made the onion simile, it also means when you do mess around with sankharas, it makes you cry. which is one excellent thing. But the best thing, he said, an onion goes on and on with an eye in the middle. Now, O-N-I-O-N. And that's brilliant, because that's what thinking does. Thinking goes on and on with an eye in the middle, and it makes you cry, and there's no solid stuff in there. There's no wisdom in it. And it does. You think of your divorce, on and on with an eye in the middle, and it makes you cry. The thinking. You think of pushing that down wheelbarrow, you think on and on. There's an eye in there. That's a problem, and it makes you suffer. And that's also will. Will goes on and on and on. And there's a very big eye in the center of your will. Your assumption, it's me who's doing this. And my God, does it make you cry. Or your choices. And lastly, consciousness. The Buddha said consciousness, he said it's a magician's trick. And that's also why I do that, what monks say is my fruit salad simile. A coconut. Coconut's vanished. And now we have an apple. Apple's vanished. Now you have a banana. Now you have a coconut. It's a magician's trick. There's nothing really there. And it also changes every moment. The continuity, that is where we get the mistake. We think it's continuous. It's not. It's particular. Boop, 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 boop. Going so fast, just like those old flicking cards. You flick the cards fast enough and you see this person, like they're moving, like they're running. That's just the illusion. So that is what the Buddha meant by delusion. Fascinating and very challenging. Ajahn, when you're pre-programmed the mind, what to do when a nimitta arises, then you are already expecting the nimitta, of course, then it doesn't come. It's oxymoron, isn't it? You've been thinking too much. When you pre-program the mind, you don't expect what you say, if a nimitta arises, this is what I'll do. If a nimitta arises, this is what I'll do. If a nimitta arises, this is what I'll do. So just pre-program the mind, if this happens, when it happens, this is what will happen. So don't expect anything. If you expect it to happen, you're wasting time. So if it does happen, this is what I will do. And that's why it works. Dr. Ajahn, you've said that psychic powers really exist. Could you please give us a few examples of psychic powers? It's a bit late tonight. Oh, episodes of Monks and Modern Days, apart from Ajahn Chah's reading minds. Thank you. What type of psychic power would you like to hear about? Flying? Last month I flew to Indonesia and back again. Yeah, another one? Sorry? Well, you know that one. Yeah, that's a smart aleck one, because you know the Buddha said of all the psychic powers, the only one which he recommends, which he praises, was teaching Dhamma. And you know, sometimes, you know, just because people say, have you got any psychic powers, Ajahn Brahm? Look, I teach 3,000, 5,000, 2,000 people at a time. So I think that I can legitimately claim the psychic power of teaching the Dhamma. So you've actually seen a monk with psychic powers. Teaching the Dhamma. That's the most important thing. Look, there was the famous story. Okay, here's a psychic power story now. Another one, because people love these things. And it's late at night. There was a famous one of this monk who lived in a forest, in a jungle somewhere, a long time ago. And it happens, if you just meditate a lot, these things just happen. It's just par for the course. And so he actually could levitate and learn how to fly. And so every morning he would actually just almost like fly for exercise. It became his little habit in the morning, just having a bit of tour around. Now the trouble is, if anybody does that, if a monk does that, someone sees you. And so the villagers saw him, and then eventually the word got to the town, and from the town to the city, from the city it got to the king at the time. There was a monk who could fly. Now, many of you would love to see a monk who flied. So imagine if you're a king, not only do you want to, but he had the power to do it. So he sent his minister up to see this monk. Now, go and find that monk and tell him to come to the palace. And the monk said, no, I don't want to go to the palace. So the minister came back, he doesn't want to come. So then the king sent the army. There's a big number of soldiers. And so this poor monk had no choice. He was actually kidnapped and sent to the palace. And the king was very nice. He said, look, I know you're a forest monk, but I want to see you fly. But also, if you can fly, you must be very wise. And I really need a wise advisor, like a monk who's, not sort of really interested in power, not corrupt, who could actually advise me on just running this kingdom. You'd be doing great service. And I know you're a forest monk, so in the palace grounds, I've built a little forest for you. And there's a little hut there, just like you've got in the forest where you live. So you can live in your hut, in the forest. For you, the perception will be you're just like back at home. But it means that I can come whenever I need to ask advice. And I'll make sure you're well fed, whatever you like to eat, nice food or rice and snails, whatever you're used to, I'm sure I'll get that for you. I'm the king, I can get whatever I like. And so the monk really didn't have much choice. But also, the king had a point there. He had a nice forest. And actually in Chitlada Palace, where the king of Thailand, he's in hospital now, but where he used to live, he also built a forest, in his grounds. And I went into the hut there because there was one monk I knew who was living there. So the king of Thailand did pretty much the same. But anyway, this king, he had this monk, and so the monk was living there for a while. Whenever the king needed some advice or some chanting or whatever, he'd come to the monk. And it was working out okay, and the monk would do his thing every morning, go for a fly around. But what happened one morning? The king was busy, and so he asked one of his daughters to bring the food for the monk. And this was one of those drop-dead gorgeous princesses. And as she was walking with the food, the monk was flying through the air. And the monk saw that princess. And he was a man, this monk. So he had one moment of lust. Just one moment, that's all it took. And straight away he lost his ability to fly, while he was still up in the air. So he had to do crash landing. And afterwards, he had his meal and he packed his bowl and robe and walked back to his forest. He realized it was just, these powers are that sensitive. Just one sort of unwholesome thought or one unwholesome state of mind or a few, you lose that power. You have to be that pure to maintain those powers. Which is one of the reasons why if a monk shows it, especially for personal gain, to get donations for the monastery, or to say, look how great I am, it soon loses it. There's a natural safety mechanism. If you're coming from the wrong place, the psychic powers disappear. You just can't get into jhana, you can't maintain them. You have to have a very pure mind. which means a lot of people don't want to show off. That's why you don't see them. It's only if sometimes a monk is having fun and he doesn't realize he gets caught out. So anyway, that's the psychic powers of the monk who's flying through his the air and lost his ability and came crashing down. So if you do develop psychic powers, when you first learn how to fly, make sure you buy a crash helmet and these things they use in football around your knees. So if you do lose your ability very quickly, at least you don't harm yourself. Okay. Is it true that in Buddhism we can change our destiny? Yes, because you don't have any destiny. Your future is totally uncertain. So you can actually change things. Obviously, there's some things you can't change. I mean, you're going to sort of die. That thing you can't change. But the direction of your life, most things, is totally up to you. However you want to move the mind, you can go any direction you like. That's a wonderful freedom. There's no such thing as destiny.
Karma,
you have so much good karma, so much bad karma, you've got a choice which one you want to use. So karma is not restricting you. It's how you use that karma defines which direction you're going to go in life. Karma is not sort of a straitjacket. Karma is this whole wealth of money, this whole wealth of fines you have to pay, whichever one you want to do. And it's amazing that you can decide, no, I've had enough with bad karma, I'm just going to do the good karma. You can do that. A lot of people don't think they can. That's why they're always receiving the fruits of bad karma. You can let it go. It's called ahosi karma. When you realize I don't have to be punished by this anymore, I can let it go. Dear Ajahn, I was lucky enough to spend some of the afternoon meditating in the hall at the monastery. I had a ball in the hall. Great place you have, by the way. I noticed a photo of Ajahn Mun on the altar. Did this monk have a personal impact on you? What was so special about him? Now, he was Ajahn Chah's teacher. So Ajahn Chah had the effect on me. So that's why we have Ajahn Mun's picture on there. Ajahn, could you please talk about the symbols of the drawing in the earth the Buddha did for his monks to explain dependent origination and transcendental dependent origination? Apparently the Buddha instructed this drawing to be hung in all monasteries. Where is it in Bodhinyana? He drew it in the earth. So that's where it must be, in the earth, under the concrete. I don't know. No, I don't know that story. That's not in the suttas. Where's that in? Oh, okay.
They said that the Theravadas, originally the Buddha had a very simple drawing. Monks were so blown away by it that they had it described. And the Buddha said, I want you to take a copy of this and make sure you hang it in the front of each monastery.
I think that's not in the original suttas. Folklore. Okay. Not in the original suttas. Could you please talk about... Oh, that's not one. Last question so we can all go to bed. Because the poor teddy bear is tired, it's almost falling asleep. There you go. Why is it when everything is so peaceful, we do not want to ask any questions anymore? How does the contentment work exactly? So it's only because you're so restless. We had so many questions today. So it's actually true because sometimes we think we can get an answer by asking a question. But you all know that once you ask one question, you get one answer. There's so many other questions come up afterwards. And in the end, we find out the final answer to all the questions.